Well, if any of you are hoping to learn all about the appearances, structure, laws and dynamics of the spiritual world tonight, you'll be sadly disappointed. Obviously that title is a very, very enormous one, and I can only make certain selections from this area, ones which I think are of particular interest to us at the moment. And also, because I should be basing this upon the experiences of Swedenborg, as Ben and Marshall has been saying, I feel that for the benefit of those of you who have not had a chance yet to get into his voluminous and not particularly easy works, that I should tell you a little bit about his life to set the scene. Swedenborg was born in 1688, which was the year after the publication of Newton's Principia, which of course set the style and tone for the sciences for the next 200 years until Einstein. And Swedenborg died in 1772. So he lived for 84 years, covering a great deal of one of the most, perhaps the most interesting centuries that there have been for a very long time. The 18th century has seen an enormous change in the outlook and thoughts of people. Well, this is a change which is beginning to be recognised, slowly only, by thinkers and historians. The main change, if I can sum it up for you, being the beginning to throw over the idea of having to submit oneself to an external authority or to dogma. And Swedenborg is able to give us the key to why that was the case. Now, Swedenborg was a Swedish scientist, philosopher, psychologist, and theologian. He was both very Christian and very universalist. Universalist in the sense that he taught that all persons from any faith or creed whatever are acceptable into the higher spiritual realms after death. The rising in the spiritual world into the heavenly communities is not based upon what you believe or know and understand. It is based on a quality of life. Nevertheless, he writes in a very Christian way. But, strangely, when he was in his younger years, he had very little to do whatsoever with theology, because he came early under the influence of the new Cartesian philosophy when he was at university in Uppsala, and he threw all his energies into scientific and philosophical undertakings, and on the basis of that his genius very quickly came to the fore, a genius which has sadly been underrated and overlooked in subsequent years. Very briefly, let me just pick out three areas, one of which will be of importance to what I have to say later on about the life after death itself. The first one is fundamental physics, and this is an area that interests me very much because I was a physicist myself for 10 years before I switched to the field of spiritual teaching. Swedenborg put forward a theory of the creation of the universe in terms of a series of particles, each one larger than the last, and starting from a dimensionless point that he called a natural point. Now the point about this, forgive the pun, the point about this is that these points and particles he saw as being fundamentally energy, they were in motion. And the originating points contained infinite energy, and there were an infinite number of these spread throughout space when it was first created by the deity. Now, I won't go into the details of this now, but the general pattern that Swedenborg put forward is being confirmed day by day, almost, in fundamental physics at the moment. Particularly, his concept that the whole of space is like an infinite reservoir out of which matter is formed, that is a current theory at the moment. But Swedenborg didn't remain working in the field of what you might call the simplest, if you like to think of atoms and electrons and protons as being simple, not that they were called such in his day. But he began to become interested not in the building bricks of the physical universe, but in what the divine was making out of those. And so his interest gradually moved up the scale until he began to centre upon the physiology of the human body. And of course, when you think of it, you realise that the human body is the most wonderful and most complex organism that the divine has brought into being. And therefore, surely, there must be something very important for us to learn from that, not just about the physiology of the body, but something about the way in which God aims to run the universe. Now, Swedenborg's anticipations of later discoveries in this area are absolutely phenomenal. I shall not bore you with technical words that even I don't understand, not being a physiologist, but I will just mention two. Swedenborg intuited that there was a synchronous motion between the lungs and the brain, which expands and contracts in the brain cavity. And this was before it was possible experimentally to discover this. There are many so-called ductless glands in the body which physiologists at the time thought served no use or function, that were useless. Swedenborg said nothing in the human body is useless, because it wouldn't have been made by God to be useless. And he anticipated correctly the functions of these particular ductless glands. He went on to do a great deal in the area of brain research. And I'll mention one thing from here, because of the current interest in left and right brain activity, to point out that Swedenborg realised that the right brain is the basis upon which we are able to operate at a deeper level. Our deeper desires and intuitions come, as it were, through the right brain, and our more logical outer functions come through the left brain. And today, of course, we have great interest in this area, because we're beginning to realise that the right brain activity of mankind has been suppressed for far too long, and that we're becoming unbalanced. Now, Swedenborg underwent a transition in 1743 at the age of 55. He was in full swing on his latest physiological work called The Kingdom of the Soul, a massive physiological treatise. And he was travelling around Europe, and in fact he was in Holland at the time, when he first began to have strange dreams of a powerful nature. And being a true scientist, he recorded his dreams. And he also realised that they needed to be interpreted, and he began to keep a record of these interpretations, which are remarkably modern, considering that he is 200 years before Freud. He realised that all the figures in these disturbing dreams must be facets of himself. So that, for instance, when he dreams of his father, then he realises that this is something to do with his hereditary nature that he has received from his father. And when he dreams of women, he interprets this as representing particular desires, strong desires or affections that he has. He had a number of dreams of a sexual nature, which he records fully because it was a private journal not intended for publication. But these sexual dreams he interprets quite simply in terms of his desires or affections. And there is one striking dream he has where he is with a particular woman whom he loves dearly. And a man comes along and takes this woman away from him, which upsets him very much. And then another woman is brought to him, and he realises that he is to accept this new woman. And in his interpretation, he is beginning to realise that he is being guided from within to give up his love of scientific research and to be led into a new, higher love. And it's the most fascinating struggle that goes on in this Journal of Dreams, as we now call it, because Swedenborg clearly doesn't want to give up this life, and he has to be literally brought to his knees before he is able to do this. And from being a very proud, arrogant young man, understandably so, having such an enormous genius, he is brought into a humbled condition, and he is prepared for the higher spiritual work that he is to be led into, which consisted of, in brief, having his all his five spiritual senses opened, so that he was fully present and alive in the spiritual world, so he claimed, at the same time he was still fully alive in the physical body. And so for the last 27 years of his life, he led this kind of dull existence, still very much a man of affairs, helping his country, putting forward papers in the House of Lords, where he was a member, and being helpful and kind to many people on many occasions. But for these 27 years, the word began to get around that this man was claiming that he could not only speak to the deceased, but that he was claiming to actually be living concurrently in the spiritual world. Now, you might think it's a little odd that the name of Swedenborg isn't better known today and what he has taught. And I think there are various reasons why he has been so overlooked. In fact, he's been almost buried, more so than Blake, who to some extent based his system of thinking upon Swedenborg's own. Partly the immensity and the depth of Swedenborg's writing is a bit off-putting to anyone. And then, particularly for the people of his day, for the Christians, he was far too critical of Christian orthodoxy. The Christian religion had got into a rut. The Catholic Church, the rut of basing salvation upon good works and obeying the Church. And the Protestant religion got into the rut of basing salvation upon a belief in the correct creed. And Swedenborg cut right at the heart of both of those heresies. And so he was very unpopular in the church of his day. But he was too Christian in his approach for the non-Christians and the esotericists, who found him apparently too narrow, although really he is universalist. And the way in which he writes is very rational, structured, and theological, and therefore people more interested in the intuitive and mystical side are liable to give him a miss again. Nevertheless, most, if not all, the significant New Age principles that are now emerging are to be found in his writings, and Blake at least has acknowledged his indebtedness to Swedenborg's insights. And I mention Blake again because he is often regarded himself as the prophet of the New Age. But I would like to suggest too that we may be nearer to the source in Swedenborg himself. Now turning to the subject of life after death and the spiritual world, I've selected certain key facets from this enormous field, but I'm going to preface this first by pointing to the essential difference between the two worlds, the spiritual and the material. What we see around us in the material world is based far more on a fixed external substratum that we call physical matter, rather than upon our inner spiritual states. Now, this makes the material world peculiar, because life is essentially spiritual. So it's matter that is the odd fish out. And all that is seen by spirit should be a reflection of whatever spirit or spirits are present. That really is the norm, and life in the physical world is odd and peculiar, and of course, as we know, it's very short-lived. Rather than naturally mirroring the qualities and conditions of the locally grouped incarnate spirits, the material world mirrors the eternal qualities of the divine life, and of course now the distortions of that life that mankind has generally introduced into its psyche from ages past up to the present. There is an objective, material atmosphere surrounding incarnate spirits, whose appearance is only barely coloured or moulded by the inner state of the observer. This, I would call it, mysterious physical atmosphere emanates from God, pouring his infinity into an infinite number of infinitely small points, called natural points by Swedenborg, from which, in a series of coarsening stages, elementary particles, atoms, molecules, liquids and solids are formed through the locking up of energy in closed volumes, and these are independent of the observing spirit or person at the gross level at which we see them, though there is some evidence that at the subatomic level the observer may have some effect on the movements of elementary particles. But the subject of my lecture is not the peculiar physical world, but what I would call the more natural world of spirit, or the spiritual world which becomes fully visible after the death of the physical body. There is a spiritual atmosphere surrounding spirits which is moulded into forms and appearances corresponding to their inner condition at the time. It is, of course, an atmosphere which is not located in fixed external space-time continuums, but it can be perhaps described as a spiritual continuation or emanation of spirit. Or putting it another way, the inner spiritual energy forms of spirits that Swinburne calls states of thought and affection project themselves into corresponding visual forms that appear as if external to the observer, though they're really a mirror of what is within. So what is really seen in the spiritual world is the inner soul expressed outwardly in picture or symbolic form, a process which follows certain laws of correspondence, to use Swedenborg's phrase. Now here I've only time to outline part of the main schemata of spiritual correspondences which Swedenborg has outlined for us. Notice, by the way, that the science of correspondences, as he calls it, is very interesting because it applies not only to the spiritual world and what you see there, but it applies to what we see around us in physical nature, and it applies to dreams, to myths, to fairy tales, and it applies to sacred scriptures, all of which we can begin to see are expressed in the language of correspondence, which is a way in which the soul projects itself out into natural forms. Firstly then, the correspondence between spiritual entities such as desires and thoughts and their symbolic visual representation is mostly based on a correspondence of use or function. Perhaps the simplest example to take here is that of light. We know what the function is that light serves in the physical world. It is that which enables us to see what is around us, to see the way ahead. And so we are very familiar with the concept of spiritual light, light in the mind, the light of the understanding, which is that which enables us to see spiritually our way ahead. And of course, in the Gospels, Jesus himself says that I am the light of the world, and we understand his meaning. We can apply the same to heat. The function which heat serves is to warm the physical body. And that which warms the spiritual body, or the spirit, is of course love. And so in our ordinary language we talk about a warm heart and so on. So these two simple illustrations point the way to the fact that there is a universal language of correspondence, which according to Swedenborg was universally known in ancient times before the dawn of history, but which became lost and degenerate as time went by and men began to fall into more and more selfish ways. Now, every correspondence has its opposite. There is true light and there is illusory light. There is bread which is good for the soul and bread which is poison for the soul, and so on. So that if you come across a particular symbol, a natural symbol like bread or water or light in the scriptures of any sort, it may have a good correspondence or a bad correspondence. And to know which it is, you'd have to go by the context. To illustrate this, I would like to take two well-known parables from the Gospels. Two that Jesus tells us, which mention birds, to show that in one case the birds represent something good, and in the second case the birds represent something bad. And in the spiritual world, if you see birds, they may be good birds or bad birds, representing good thoughts or bad thoughts that are flying or flitting through your mind. In the parable of the mustard seed, Jesus tells how a grain of mustard seed grows into a great tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. And it's perfectly clear that he means something good by this, that something which starts off very small in us, which he calls the kingdom of heaven, is able to grow until it branches out so much that the birds of the air are able to find a home there. But if you read in the same chapter the parable of the sower and the seed, so who casts his seed all over the place and it falls on different kinds of ground, we learn there that some of the seed falls on shallow ground and the plants spring up quickly and the birds come and eat them up. So there the birds have a bad correspondence because they are destroying the good seeds that are sown by the good sower. Now, in the physical world, we have several kingdoms. The mineral, the vegetable, the animal, the human, and the astrological kingdoms. And Swedenborg gives us the key to how to interpret these in general. And when we think about it, it's pretty obvious. The mineral kingdom is a kingdom where nothing grows except in physical size or number. Things can coalesce or be broken down. Now, in the human mind, there is that which corresponds to that. There are the things which you can keep adding and storing away and taking out or breaking down. And that is facts, factual knowledge. Our minds are, at the moment, stuffed with a great deal of factual knowledge. Knowledge which isn't doing anything except just lying in our memory. And so stones in the mineral kingdom are used in this correspondential way in the scriptures and when they are seen in the spiritual world to represent these things which just lie around and don't grow. But you can do things with them. You can build a house, an altar, a temple, and so on. But when we come to the vegetable kingdom, in the vegetable kingdom things grow, starting from a seed. They go up and they branch outwards and they bear leaves and fruit. And clearly the same thing happens in the human mind if we do not let the human mind become a desert. Our thoughts and intuitions and our perceptions, those are the things that grow. We talk about how one thought leads to another and our thinking branches out and may bear fruit in our life. So whenever we come across plants and trees in the scriptures or read about them in descriptions of life after death, we are reading about that which grows in the human mind. But it is something growing which is relatively cold because plants do not have heat, and things which do not move us from one place to another because plants remain rooted to the spot. Here, with simply the vegetable kingdom, we have a picture of a human mind which is mentally growing and developing, wonderfully perhaps, but there may be something missing that leaves the soul or spirit rooted to the spot, unable to get out of its world and meet with other people. The third kingdom, the animal kingdom, is the kingdom that represents that in the human soul that enables us to actually move out of ourselves and move towards other people. This, the desires and the affections. to the heart. And so every animal and beast represents a different affection or desire within us. And of course there are good animals and bad animals, or animals that obviously are doing something good or something bad in a particular situation. I have the time now, I would love to really be able to describe to you the Garden of Eden story, which contains two trees and a snake, and show you how beautifully we can apply the simple laws of correspondence to get us on the lines to understanding what it is that causes us to fall away, and is represented by Adam and Eve's fall. And of course at the end of the Bible we're told that the tree of life appears in the holy city New Jerusalem, and we need to get back to the tree of life, but I must pass on from that. The human kingdom, human persons, they represent the coordinating rational constructive faculty of the mind, because human beings are lords over the lower kingdoms and can push them around and construct them in the ways they want to. So very briefly, that gives you some idea of how correspondences can be seen to be a kind of science that can be developed. It's not a vague, merely intuitive way of understanding, although intuition still has to come in as well, because the left and the right brains need to be coordinated and balanced, ideally, in everything that we do. Now, in the spiritual world, there are what Swedenborg calls real appearances and illusory appearances. Now, this is because we have an internal and an external part to our nature. The external part of our nature is what Jung would call the persona, the outer mask of our personality, which may or may not reflect accurately our true inner nature, how we're really feeling and developing inside. Now, if in the spiritual world, if our internal and external natures agree or correspond, then what they project, and therefore what we would see around us, would be a real appearance, because it would be a reflection of our inner nature. But if our external personality does not match our inner state, then what we see is illusory, as for the aspect of a hallucination or a dream, and is less substantial, because hallucinations are things which are threatened constantly by the inbreaking of reality. It is hellish or selfish states that induce illusory appearances, just as even in the material world the neurotic and the psychotic misunderstands or misuses the real situation that he is in. So spiritually, if we become selfish, we become spiritually neurotic or psychotic, and what we think we see in the spiritual world may not correspond to reality. Mind you, I would just add in passing that this is a blessing on the part of God, because otherwise very selfish people would be literally seeing nothing but hell all around them all the time, because of the hell within inside themselves. But they are permitted to live in an illusory, hallucinatory world a lot of the time. They can imagine, for instance, for some part of the time, that they are dressed in magnificent clothes and sitting on thrones and ordering people about in great palaces. The trouble is, as soon as any good spirit or angel comes into the vicinity, all that picture collapses, and they see themselves as ugly and in rags and sitting on a stone. The structure of the spiritual world. Like many others before and after him, Swedenborg became aware of the spiritual world as a series of ascending or descending levels from pure perfect love and goodness, which is the infinite divine, down through various degrees of finite goodness and wisdom, to their mirror image distortions in corresponding degrees of inward turned self-love or evil. So you have the heavenly levels coming down to natural levels, and a mirror image underneath of hellish levels. This picture, though true, is only a simple one-dimensional cross-section or map, as it were. The way in which the full picture can be described is both startling, simple, and perhaps obvious once perceived. The total form of the spiritual world is that of the human body. Not, I hasten to add, the shape. Correspondingly, the divine, insofar as human freedom allows, the divine draws all spirits together into the corresponding set of interrelated functions. So, for instance, Swedenborg will often refer to meeting and conversing with spirits from the liver, he says, or spirits from the lungs, or from the cerebrum, or from the outer skin of the brown man. And remember, he doesn't mean the shape, he means the use or function performed by that organ. Now we can see that it's no wonder that Swedenborg was able to anticipate so many modern physiological and neurological discoveries. In the spirit, he was walking amongst and observing the inner functions of the human organism, and conversing, we might say, with the cells of the grand man of the spiritual world. And the grand man, or Adam Kadmon, whatever we call it, is God's perfect plan and image of himself, the Word or Christ form. And we have that whole perfect plan laid out inside our own bodies. What numberless research projects of true worth await future psychologists and sociologists with good physiological training, perhaps I should add, once they realize that the ideal structured and functioning mind and the ideally structured and functioning society is mirrored in the familiar and well-studied human body. And it's fascinating to read in Swedenborg's works of how persons entering the spiritual world at death are correspondingly the spiritual food that is entering the mouth of the grand man. And from there, the spiritual food passes down the alimentary canal of the spiritual world, which he calls the world of spirits, which is intermediate between the heavens and the hells. The bad food, as this food passes down the alimentary canal, it is of course broken down into what is good food for the body and what is bad. The good food is taken inwardly into the heavenly realms of the spiritual world, and the bad food passes on down and emerges out of the rectum and goes into what Swedenborg calls the monstrous man, which is a rather horrible mirror image, as it were, of the grand man. It's rather horrible because all the parts, which are spirits who are choosing to be selfish beings, have trouble being held together in any kind of useful, organized form, because they're always breaking out into fights and troubles with each other. So whereas fundamental physics takes us back to the origin of creation and its mystical oneness with the deity, physiology is the science which should guide man according to spiritual correspondences in his outward relations to others and to society. Now, what we've been looking at so far we might call the statics or the structure of the spiritual world. Now I want to look briefly at the dynamics of growth and development in that world, remembering that because we are spirits now, we live on the spiritual plane even now. So what I say applies very much to our own experience of life. Over 200 years ago, Swedenborg had a vision whilst meditating on the skin of an intertwined spiral. Today we know it as the DNA double helix, the fundamental unit of organic life. And here we have perhaps the most powerful image or mandala of spiritual growth and development in this world and the next. The helix pattern combines two major views on life: the old Greek view of cyclic nature returning ever the same, the eternal recurrence, and the modern Darwinian evolutionary view of steady ascent or progress. Think of the helix going upwards. Now this cyclic picture is clearly imaged in the diurnal and seasonal cycles in nature. And again, if we want to understand what's going on inside us spiritually, we should look around us at what's happening in nature, because the two correspond. In the temperate zones, day and night give rise to striking cyclic changes in the degree of light, and summer and winter give rise to striking cyclic changes in the degree of heat. But as above, so below, as within, so without, our own states reflect the changing days and seasons, though not in this world, in their fixed space and time. Spiritual light, as we were saying earlier, is that which enables you to perceive the reality and the truth of your life. And spiritual heat is that which enables you to feel loved and able to radiate love to others. Now, have you not noticed how those states fluctuate psychically in your own experience? Does not Sartori always give way to some form of the dark night of the soul in the more deeply spiritually aware or advanced until the next stage of further enlightenment? Do you always feel the same power in you to radiate love to others? Deeper spiritual states, you see, wax and wane, ebb and flow, rise and fall, but of course independently of outer circumstances in this world, but not independently of what we see if we are in the spirit. No wonder the Greeks thought rather pessimistically of the endless recurrence. But wait, man is less fixed than the peculiar physical world of nature. Man's spirit is capable of faster evolution or ascent of the helix than material plants and animals. But that evolution or ascent is never straight up, but it is always cyclic. Spiritual ascent takes place only through alternating light and dark, heat and cold, enlightenment and doubt, love and lovelessness. In the spiritual world, even in the bright higher regions called the heavens, there is still day and night, summer and winter, yang and yin, though to us in our spiritually immature states here at present, that night up there would still seem very bright to us. It would still be like bright daylight relative to our spiritual advancement, and the winter by comparison would still seem very warm to us. So we should perhaps refer to these conditions in the spiritual world as the evening time and the cooler season. Now, why should this flow back and forth between opposites be the necessary eternal dynamic for spiritual growth and ascent? A pattern which, by the way, is reflected perfectly in the very long biblical story, where the fortunes of the chosen people rise and fall as you go from the beginning to the end of the Bible. First, reflect on how the helix is demarcating two dimensions of spiritual change. The alternating one around the circle between light and dark, warm and cold, yang and yin, the rise and fall of state, and the overall permanent change or ascent by the vertical axis. In practice, in our life, we tend to confuse these two axes of development, and we wonder why we keep slipping back from enlightenment and the power to love, even though we can't find anything that we've done wrong in our life at the time. the dark night of the soul is actually on the spiritual path. It's on the spiral upwards. Light's the dark, light's the dark. But on a yin turn of the cycle, and therefore it is just as essential as any light or landing section of the path. As we're thinking about, the dark is just as important as the light for our spiritual growth. The overall effect of the helical dynamic is spiritual maturation with developing humility, which would not be the case if we were able to go straight up. We would go straight into the pharisaical state, and we may know some people who are in danger of doing that, who may have had so much enlightenment that it's removed them from ordinary man, and they're living on their own up in the clouds, as it were. This danger is illustrated in the Bible by the builders of the Tower of Babel, who were building a tower going straight up out of their own man-made bricks. But unless you turn and become as children, says the greatest teacher of all, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. It is the rise and fall of spiritual enlightenment and the power of love that keeps us from identifying with the love and the wisdom that we are receiving from the divine source. You see the danger? If God gives us something of love and wisdom, he runs the risk that we will identify with that and imagine that that is our own, that we are the source, and then he's lost us. And so we have the light and the dark, the yin and the yang. And in this way we are reminded again and again that what is given to us by God is still and always is his, because he can let it be taken away any time. The more we realize that we are only a channel, the more love and wisdom can be poured through us, and the greater is our spiritual maturity, and the higher we rise in the spiritual world, and the more interior is our function in the grand man of the spiritual world. This then, the helix, is the spiritual dynamic discovered by Swedenborg from his spiritual world experiences, discoverable in the underlying account of the soul's journey as described in the Bible, and it is discoverable in our own personal experience. It is an eternal dynamic. It is a helix which is ascending to infinity, bringing our spirit ever closer to the one loving source of creation. In other words, the highest angels are still on that helical course. Now, spiritual life is multidimensional. It is not limited to simply two or three dimensions. And I'll briefly outline one more spiritual dynamic pattern, which is clearly recognizable again in the Bible and again in our own inner life. And it illustrates also the closeness and the interdependence of the spiritual and the material worlds. This is the pattern of ascent and descent, not to be confused with the yin and the yang that I've been mentioning earlier, or with the overall ascent pattern. We must try and keep our dimensions clearly distinguished. This motif or dynamic is seen in the Bible, for instance, in the image of angels ascending and descending upon Jacob's ladder, and in the Gospels upon the Son of Man. Also, it's to be seen in Jesus' ascent and descent of the Mount of Transfiguration. It is also present in Christ's message of having to go away from his disciples in order that, he says, in order that he might come to them as the Spirit of Truth or the Counselor. He must go away in order to be able to return. Angels, that is, highly evolved spirits, for angels are not a separate creation. We are all trainee angels. Angels ascend towards God in order that they might descend to those still on the plane of life. This is the well-known Bodhisattva ideal. Voluntarily choosing to come back from an elevated position to bring down, to use the old Greek myth, fire from heaven for mankind's benefit. It is a movement of the spirit from the inner life up the mountain to the outer life down on the plain into the world to give spiritual aid to the world. And that is why angelic spirits are so close to us here and now. They don't leave us because they're higher up than we are. They bring themselves down as close to our level as possible so that they might communicate what is good and true to us at the inner level of our mind in a way that we can appreciate and understand. So the teacher simplifies his teaching for the child, and so God comes down as Jesus the Christ to where man is. That is the pattern. He who has ascended chooses to descend. We are being trained here and now for eternal life in the world of spirit. We shouldn't let the veil of the flesh kid us into thinking that the laws of the spiritual world won't come into operation for us until we die. We are spirits now, and the angels are only our brothers and sisters, persons better able than we are at present to channel love and wisdom from the divine into neighbouring spirits. Now there I'm going to stop to give you a chance to open up any area you'd like to. It's an enormous field because Swedenborg covers almost every aspect, and I'm sure you may have some special interests that I've not covered, and I hope I'll be able to give you some information and answer that will be helpful. Thank you.